Hello, and welcome to the Development Debrief with Catherine Van Sickle, the stories-based podcast that interviews professionals, donors, and thought leaders in the field of fundraising. Happy FY21. This year comes at us with a new set of challenges and opportunities. We're tasked with continuing to rethink our donor relationships and build new ones. At the beginning of this season, I interviewed consultant Craig Smith. Craig is a business partner of today's guest, Dan Shepherd. They work together on sharing and teaching the four decisions. In today's episode, I will talk with Dan about his creation of the four decisions and how we can use it for this fiscal year. We talk about how to get out of our own way with donor work and suggest working with a one sheet to organize your donor strategy. Dan Shepherd is principal of the Shepherd Group, which provides training and coaching services around the skill sets most valuable to frontline fundraisers. His training focuses on the intersection of major gifts and planned gifts and is based on the philosophy that, from the donor's perspective, they're one and the same. Dan's goal is to teach the frontline fundraiser to become an effective charitable gift planner. A fundraising professional since 1986, Dan has served as plan giving director for the Florida State University Foundation, director of development for the Pamplin College of Business at Virginia Tech, director of gift planning for the Citadel Foundation, and director of development for the Chase College of Law at Northern Kentucky University. Dan has taught hundreds of fundraising professionals the tools and techniques he will share with us today. His client list includes Columbia University, Cornell University, the Smithsonian Institute, Florida International University, Rochester Institute of Technology, the World Wildlife Fund, and many more. Now let's get started. Dan, thank you for being here with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I appreciate the invitation.
So we're here to talk about your program, The Four Decisions. And then you and I talked and we had thought it could be really helpful for people to talk about how we could apply some of the pillars and principles that you've put together to our remote work, since, you know, we continue to be in an unknown zone as traveling officers and we need to continue to do our work. So let's start with the four decisions. What is it and how did you come up with it?
I suppose it was about 20 years ago. I was at a fundraising conference at the end of a long day of training sessions, sitting at the bar with some friends. And of course, we were all bragging about our successes and commiserating about our failures. For some reason, I talked about a couple of gifts that had gotten away from me. And a friend of mine looked me right in the eye and he said, Dan, what you ought to do is a hindsight analysis. Figure out what you did that works, what you did that didn't work. And I found that there was a common denominator with the ones who had eventually said yes. And that, Catherine, was my professional epiphany. When I realized in some degree of detail and in some sequence, everybody who says yes will have made four simple decisions. They all will have decided, why do I care enough about this organization to meet with a fundraiser? And I don't say that entirely tongue in cheek. It's simply a reminder that just about everybody we meet with knows who we are and what we want. Then they will have decided, what do I care enough about that I would consider supporting financially? And then, and this is where the gift planning part of it, our profession comes into play, they will decide, how can I afford to do that? And finally, reflecting on why they care, what they care about, how they could make a gift, they'll decide, will I make this commitment? So I decided I should try this out and see if there's anything to it. And I committed to pursuing this four-step agenda with all my possible donors, and it worked. So I did it some more. I refined and I fine-tuned the details and the language, and it worked better. And it worked for outright gifts, for deferred gifts. It worked for blended, multi-part gifts. This simple four-part agenda, these four decisions, gave me a path to help my donors find the best gift plans for them.
That's amazing.
It changed my career arc. It changed my whole approach to the work that I do.
And how did it change your career arc?
Well, I raised more money.
Of course.
Both outright and deferred. So my philosophy became to find the gift plan that's best for this donor sitting across this coffee table. And I didn't want to narrow my pursuit of gifts to definitions like major gifts and planned gifts. And if we were doing this live, you'd see me doing the air quotes.
Yeah.
I didn't invent this phrase, but when I first saw it probably 15 years ago or so, I realized that what I'd been doing was practicing gift planning.
And that's how they can become larger, right? When they're planned and not responding to something that someone's asking for that's specific, that's for some other agenda.
Or rated gift capacity amount. You ask for $100,000 because that's what the wealth screening said, and then you cross your fingers.
It is simple. It's about listening. It's about doing your homework. But that we tend to get in our own way in being afraid to just ask the question to get the answer that we know we need. And so what I'm curious to hear more from you on is how this structure helps fundraisers from getting in their own way and getting to the important knowledge that we need to know about this individual prospect.
Once I realized that I had this simple four-item agenda that I could intentionally pursue, it became increasingly easy. It was both over a lengthy time frames, and in any given moment, I could pause and I could ask myself, which decision do I need to be working on right now? Where in this overall agenda am I? Boy, that came in handy with relationships I've been working on for several months over several contacts. In some cases, relationships over several years. It just helped me declutter. It helped me focus. It freed me from all the unnecessary and the complicated details of moves management. And it allowed me to include my donor in the conversation. You know what that looks like.
So does that mean that every fundraiser should be thinking in their meetings, what question are we going to be focusing on today?
Well, anybody who decides to embrace what I have to offer, who takes a look and comes to the realization that, yeah, the donor is going to make four decisions. And if you decide to pursue relationship building from that perspective, then it can be that simple. Which of the four decisions will I want to be talking about?
Dan, I have heard you use the phrase donor participatory fundraising.
And I struggled with the phrase donor participatory. I've been looking for several years for something that takes us the next step beyond donor-centered fundraising. Donor-centered fundraising is talking about the donor. Donor participatory fundraising is about talking with the donor. Now I know that's a little nuanced. But I believe words have a deep impact on how we think and therefore how we act. Once I started to apply my new discovery and to field test the growing language of the four decisions, because it has evolved as I found my voice, I learned that the structure intentionally invites the donor to share that agenda, to actively participate in planning their gifts. So, donor participatory fundraising, until somebody comes up with a better phrase.
I think that's so true. And I think it's become even more true in the last 4 months. a conversation on another episode with Tara Gans, who is a donor who was willing to speak on the show. And she talked very explicitly about wanting to be part of the solution as we are wading through these unknown waters for our institutions. You know, she made clear in the episode that including her in that process would evoke a bigger commitment, would inspire her to invest more. I think that is great. And it's interesting, we use donor-centric a lot at Columbia, and we say, as a central team, we say we're a donor-centric team. But to start thinking about participatory, that's powerful.
I think so.
So how has your program evolved over the years? You told us about your aha moment. The wonderful thing is not only has it helped you and, you know, made your career even more exciting and successful, but it has impacted many, including me. Would love to just hear how you started teaching it and how many people, if you could approximate, have tried it now. I'm happy to share some of my experience.
Oh, thank you. Well, we get back to finding one's voice. It took practice. People who know me will tell you I'm an inveterate tweaker. So I was constantly, as I began to work with this, working on how I introduced this four-part agenda, how I explained, how I invited specific parts of the conversations as I worked to find my voice. I've taught this to almost 700 fundraising professionals, which is pretty exciting. Those students, including you, by the way, have taught me a whole lot. Listening to my students as you have found your voices.
What I'm taking from what you just said is that you enjoy the evolution.
We're in the relationships business, and relationships aren't scripted. They're not static. They are alive and fluid. And if I can't, in my training and coaching, be alive and fluid, I've missed the whole point.
I'm thrilled to have been part of it and to have learned it and to have put it into practice. We can get stuck, or I can get stuck with particular donors, and it takes our teams and our networks to help us figure out what the next step is. And I think the four decisions really does provide clarity with that process. And I can sort of sit and think, okay, I know the why, the what, and the how. Maybe it's time to ask, or maybe I need to know more about the how, or whatever it may be as it relates to those four things. It really does help. When it can feel complicated to us, the truth is it's simple for the donor.
That's very well put. You've been paying attention.
I've been fortunate enough to receive your consulting as a Columbia employee, and there may be people that are listening that have, although I would argue whether you've taken it or not, you can always continue to work on it. I sort of think of it as like a lifelong sport, like yoga. But for people who haven't had the opportunity and the special chance to take your course, they might not know that you do have a document, a one-page document that outlines the four decisions. And one of the things that you recommend is that we literally write out in four squares what we've learned in each category, and then also how it relates to asset and particular life events for these donors. How could our listeners think about adopting this for our remote purposes in terms of planning phone calls and Zoom meetings and organizing our portfolios as we go into July and think about our projections for FY21?
You're talking about my four decisions checklist, right?
I am.
Okay. You know, I designed that, first of all, as a teaching tool, a way to introduce the construct and the language of the four decisions. I really quickly discovered that it's more valuable in practical use. It's a simple two-page checklist that it's aligned to these four decisions. There's a section to take notes on what you, the fundraiser, learned about each of the decisions. So there's a big blank box on why, so you can make notes on what you learn about your prospects' gift motivation. There's a section on what, on gift purpose, another big blank box, so you can make notes on what likely designation the donor might consider a gift for. And then it really gets valuable when you get into the details of the how part of the relationship, where you have some space to check off any specific life events and milestones that you learn about that might have charitable implications. There's space to note any specific assets you learn about, which of course encourages the fundraiser to ask intentionally about assets, because that's where the big gifts come from. There's a section where you can check off what you've learned about tax concerns. And then there's a section on personal and family concerns, because that matters in how people are willing to allocate their assets, their resources. Then all these topics can combine within the big topic of how very often, and it helps the fundraiser figure out the best gift plan. And you've got all of that condensed onto this one simple page checklist. And of course, you can have supporting notes elsewhere, but visually, you've got this one sheet of paper to look at and figure out, where am I? There's the back of the page, which provides a framework that you can use to brief your gift planning experts so that you can work together and determine the best gift plan to suggest for the prospect you're talking about. What I learned is that not only is that four decisions checklist a really handy training tool. It's an even better planning tool. And it's a vehicle that you can use to work more closely with your gift planning colleagues. It became a team building tool, which excited me even more.
That is so true for me. I found that being able to verbally process what I've learned in a visit or a prospect meeting really helps me think about the next step.
I think the checklist for those who are visual learners and visual thinkers, it's right there. It's a snapshot. And it's segmented so you can figure out, what do I know about why they care? What do I know about what they care about? What are the details I've learned about how they could afford to make the gift?
The how section is probably the hardest. Do you think other students would agree?
Oh, absolutely. Probably without exception, because we're getting into things like tax law and more complicated and sophisticated gift plans and strategies and how to give away various assets. I think spending the time and investing in professional development and learning all those things is how you build a career. Besides, that's where the big gifts live.
And now seems like a great time to do it, wouldn't you say?
People seem to have some free time these days. They're not in cars and airports as much as they had been. So it might be timely to do any sort of valuable study. It's a great moment for professional development.
We have pointed at this idea of overthinking and overcomplicating. Why do you think we tend to do that? Why do we fear asking the necessary questions of our donors?
Let's talk about fundraising fears. The fear of being rejected, the fear of the unknown. Where's my crystal ball? The fear of failure. You know, these are real emotions and they can freeze up even the most experienced fundraiser. They're honest. We have to acknowledge them and embrace them. But the more important thing to do about fears is to learn how to deal with them. You know, and I think the biggest fear relative to what we're talking about is having to admit to your donor that you don't know the answer to anything he might possibly ask you, which is utterly unrealistic.
Especially now.
It says you have to know the answer to everything before you dare ask anything.
Right.
And that simple, irrational, but very real fear keeps a lot of fundraisers from asking those questions in the first place. What's the magic answer, Catherine, to any question you could possibly be asked?
I'm not sure, but I would be happy to get back to you on that.
And how is that anything but great news? Your prospect is engaged, is active, is interested, is asking you for more information, for some detail. And you get a chance to say, I appreciate that. I've just reached the limit of my current level of expertise, but I know somebody who has greater expertise, and let's have another meeting. I love the magic answer. I teach my students to embrace the magic answer. It's a signal that you're doing good work.
I have to tell you though, Dan, you know, I've done a lot of meetings, and I'm sure not as many as you, but I still get nervous. I mean, I've had full conversations with people about everything they're worth. And every time I start over, I still get nervous. Is that the same for you?
Oh, sure. I liken it to performance. You're doing an extemporaneous live performance with somebody who you just cast 2 weeks ago when you called them on the phone to meet with you. If you're not nervous, I think you're in trouble. And your nervousness and anxiety, those fears, they're all different forms of energy. And right. What we all need to learn somehow at some time is how to channel that energy, how to focus that energy and use it. And it's another one of those things that you just learn by doing.
Do you have any rituals that you use either before you present or before you work with a donor or used to work with donors that would help you get in the right zone?
I read a book probably 25 years ago on positive visualization. And I've practiced visualization for a long time, imagining sitting in the car before I went up to the door to ring the bell that I was going to have a positive outcome to this meeting. And I would say that over to myself. I'm going to leave this meeting with something good having happened. that will be beneficial for both my donor and for the organization.
Now that you mention it, I think I have too, in terms of picturing the ideal outcome and knowing that something in some variation of that, if that were to happen, it would be a success. I think being really clear before any meeting of what you're hoping to get out of it will help that actually happen.
Yeah. And you can fall into a trap with visualization. Your visualization statement probably shouldn't be, I'm going to come away from this meeting with a $1 million gift. That's a dangerous pressure that you don't want to impose on either yourself or your donor. If the visualization statement could be something like, this meeting will result in a positive outcome for all of our parties. I allow for good things to happen, but it opens.
It's very calming.
Yeah.
It is.
It's another thing that I used to use to get out of my own way.
I'm considering, well, I know I'm going to go through the process of redetermining who my top 20 are in my portfolio and pull through it. And I'm thinking that I want to use either the four decisions checklist or some kind of physical thing that I can put next to my laptop as I prepare for that meeting and that I can do to mentally prepare. Because I was talking with one of my other friends in the business, and she was saying, you know, the stress of when the car is going to arrive and are you going to be ready for the next meeting? And did you have everything that you needed in your bag? Do you have a snack? You know, all of that stuff from on the road has now been eliminated. And so we can do 5 minutes of meditation before we call. We can have things written out on a piece of paper and look at it as we're on the phone. And these are things that I think we should embrace while we still can. Do you agree?
Absolutely. Although I'm not in the field any longer, you know, I retired from being a practicing fundraiser in 2013 to focus all my time and energy on the teaching. I still have vivid memories of the sorts of things you're talking about. And I imagine there are plenty of road warriors who will be listening to this who kind of miss the travel.
The rush.
The excitement. Oh my goodness. At the same time, the things you just talked about are things that I hope everybody who's still in the field is working on in this quiet time. And right. That's learning how to be quiet and focused and positive within the framework of what we're doing.
I think if we can use this time to really get to know ourselves in terms of understanding our voice, knowing what sort of combination of factors needs to get us just nervous enough to be at the top of our game, we can come out so much stronger when we do get back on the road and when we do have the opportunity to start engaging non-virtually with our pools and our colleagues and just continue to grow. So I really appreciate all of the tips that you gave us. And I hope that people consider creating their own four decisions checklist.
Well, so do I, because it works.
That's a pretty good reason. And I can say that it does, and it has worked in my own portfolio work and my own work with donors. Like I said, I think I'm going to take some time, even with people that I have worked with for 2 or 3 years. I might know the why and the what, but I haven't even started talking about the how. Or I might know the how, but I need to spend time in FY21 learning really about the why. Maybe that got lost along the way.
Yeah. You know, it reminds me of some of the fundraisers who I coach who talk with me about their prior donors. They've been in stewardship for 2 or 3 years, and the fundraiser is trying to figure out how to go into cultivation for the next gift cycle. And I'll say, well, let's review where we are in the four decisions. Talk to me about your donor's why. And it's amazing how often the fundraiser doesn't know why the donor gave in the first place. And I suggest maybe that's why you're stuck.
In your experience, do you find that the why can change depending on the gift, or is it usually pretty tried and true?
You know, why can mature? So many things in our lives, thank goodness, mature and grow and evolve. And why can expand? I think the thing that expands more, though, is the what. I think of somebody whose first gift to a school where I was working was to endow a scholarship, and then got to know the dean, and through stewardship activities, got to know the university president, was invited to serve in some volunteer capacity, learned about new initiatives, etc. So the gift purpose for the next gift or the gift after that expanded from an academic department focus to a university-wide transformational focus. Those things can change, and that's good.
And I'm sure the how is pretty fluid as well, depending on...
Sure, it has a whole lot to do with people's changing circumstances. It has to do with timing. It has to do with, is it time for me to liquidate some asset, whether it's something that I need to do or something that I want to do? What will the tax implications of that liquidation event be? Is it a good time to plug in a charitable component to that? And the fundraiser who's actively engaged with that person, who's regularly checking in and suggesting, you know, let's periodically talk about what's coming up in your life, because we might find that somewhere in these next 6 months might be the time to make that gift we've been talking about for the last 2 years.
Well, I really appreciate us talking about getting in our own way. Do you have any final tips about clearing the sort of runway for us as we do our work and try to close the biggest gifts possible?
Stop overthinking the work. When you're sitting across the coffee table, it really is as simple as this. Why does she care? What does she care about? How can I help her say yes? And sometimes she will have one of those aha moments, and she'll realize that she can make the gift before you have to ask.
And there we are with step four.
Yep.
Thank you for all of your tips. I know they've helped me, and I hope they will help others that are listening. And I would love to end with my signature question, which is, Dan, what do you know for sure?
What I know for sure is that all the donors are alike, especially in what motivates them to give. Catherine, I've worked for and consulted with a variety of nonprofits over 3 decades, and the leadership, staff leadership, board leadership of so many of them would often advise me, Dan, our donors are different. So once I had some time to get into the work and get to know some of those donors, I learned in just about every case that what was different was how the organization treated its donors. Some of them took their donors for granted. Some did a poor job of articulating their case for support. Some did poor stewardship and reporting. And they all chose to blame their donors for their institutional shortcomings. Here's what's true about all donors. They want to know the nonprofits they support do work that means something to them, that their philanthropic investment is going to be used effectively. They want to learn how their gifts are put to use. They want to feel appreciated, and they want to work with fundraisers who are confident and trustworthy. They want it to be a fun and satisfying relationship.
I think as long as we can be clear with ourselves and our donors, we have a lot to look forward to.
I think that's very well put, and I hope everybody listening has a wonderful fundraising year as you get back up and back out there and continue to engage in those very special relationships. So I wish you all the very best in the work, and thank you.
Thank you, Dan.
I know we can all have a successful year if we're willing to include our donors in our strategy through donor participatory fundraising. Feel free to reach out if you'd like to talk more about the Four Decisions Checklist or other ideas to work through your donor pipelines for this year. I'm happy to continue the conversation or make an introduction with our guest, Dan. As always, feel free to reach out on LinkedIn or Instagram at devdebrief. You can also email me at devdebrief@gmail.com. Thanks and have a great year.